I'm pretty sure that most of you know this, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if you know it better than me. So Fiona and I were chatting earlier this week, as we regularly do, about what to put on the sign outside the church building. And I confess, it did cross my mind that "enter at your own risk" might be appropriate. And I say this because, well, the church is often a rather challenging and disturbing institution. Church isn't easy, and it's never been easy. And so, believe me, I really do get it as to why people leave the church. Crossed my mind more than once. And so far this morning's been pretty good for me, but the day's young. I can still be spurred into that line of thinking. And I was thinking about this issue this week because I was watching the scandal that's been unfolding in the highly influential Willow Creek Church in Chicago. And it's been painful to watch because that particular church has been really, really helpful to me and literally to millions of other people as they've tried to reimagine being a church and a culture that's changing faster than anyone can anticipate or keep up with. How do you share the gospel in a culture that's changing that fast? It's extraordinarily difficult. The founding pastor, Bill Hybels, is a most gifted leader. He has a remarkable vision. But he has been accused of sexual harassment over the last decades. And while there hasn't yet been a hearing, certainly the number of complaints and the people who are complaining suggests that, well, to me anyway, that some lines may have been truly crossed. Certainly trust has been badly broken. To compound the messiness, whether the charges are true or not, the current senior pastors and the board of elders have all resigned, and rightly so. Because whether the allegations are true or not, they've realized that they have just handled the situation terribly and has brought the church into disrepute. And so I can only imagine the struggles of the people within this 25,000 member congregation as they attempt to find some way forward. And so I'm sure that some are looking to leave, and I'm positive that some have already left. Of course, the recent reports out of Pennsylvania in the U.S. about the cover-ups of sexual abuse by some Roman Catholic priests, abuse of children and young people over the last 70 years, And it was a grand jury report, not a church report. I wish it had been a church report. But it was actually a grand jury report, sadly. And it described generations of bishops failing to protect the most vulnerable of people. And the scale of betrayal just staggers the imagination. And note that this is just part of one state. There's 49 other states. And of course, then there's the corresponding scandal in Ireland. And with the Pope's visit this weekend, it's just brought it to the surface again. It's hollowed out the Irish church, as many people have just simply rejected its moral authority. And now, we in the United Church, we shouldn't get too smug. We get to bear at least a portion of the legacy of the residential schools abuse that happened on our watch. And we've sure had our share of sexual misconduct by clergy, even here on tiny, perfect Vancouver Island. And pretty much every time that happens, people leave. Not that it has to be something as dramatic as sexual misconduct. Some years ago, a friend of mine was moving from one city to another, from Kamloops to Vancouver. And she called a former minister who we both knew. And she wanted to chat with him because she was going to be living near the church she was currently serving. And so she was looking to go there. And she told me that he never called her back after she made the initial call. And that's the last time she attended church, which is more than 40 years ago now. I have no idea what happened there. They're both really, really fine people. He was an excellent pastor. But something somewhere broke down. And another person left the church. Not that I'm surprised, as those of you who were here last Sunday will remember, I am a great believer in the doctrine of the total depravity of humankind. I believe that sin is certainly revealed in humans, and the church is only populated by flawed, though redeemed, human beings. So who would be surprised if we're going to run into some rather impressive displays of failure? Not me. I suspect not you. Because you continue to attend here in spite of our obvious imperfection, and at times our most impressive errors. No, the church isn't easy. Then it never has been. It's been that way from the very beginning. It's right there in the book of Acts, that first record of the Christian church. And that very first church got some things strikingly wrong as well. And if you then keep on reading through the letters in the New Testament, letters of Paul and others, they're trying to get the church onto some track because they regularly veered off. And every time they did it. You got to suspect that some people left. But even if we could fix all those things, even if we could be a church that didn't fall into any error at all, even if we could manage our behavior in such a way as to eliminate all the crossings of boundaries that have occurred over the last 2,000 years, even if we were successful in making this an institution where we didn't hurt our own members, people would still leave. Because we have an even bigger problem. And the bigger problem is Jesus. Those of you who have been reading along in the gospel passages from the lectionary for the last month will surely have noted that we've been spending pretty much the entirety of it in the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John. We just left out a couple of verses along the way, but it's generally the whole of the sixth chapter of John. And the chapter begins with the only miracle you'll find in all four of the Gospels. It's there in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and yes, John. The feeding of the 5,000. And it's a high point. Jesus has made the crowd very happy. To the point where some are declaring him to be a prophet. And Jesus ends up retreating from that scene because he sees that they're going to try and force him into being their king. And what follows is that famous nature miracle of Jesus walking on the water. And then we have this extended circling of the notion of Jesus being the bread of life. That goes on for the rest of the chapter, which is, of course, connected to the feeding story at the beginning of the chapter. I find it to be a fairly dense read, not an easy read, as Jesus speaks to the disciples and others who are interested in Jesus. He speaks about bread and food. And if you get the feeling that Jesus and his audience are talking at cross purposes during that conversation, then I would suggest you're definitely getting as to what's going on. I was recently chatting with a retired clergy friend of mine who's been doing some pulpit supply over the last month. And she was saying with a laugh that if she'd known that they were going to be having to preach on this section of John, she might have taken the summer off. Because it's a tricky section. It really is. It's rather complicated. And what with Jesus declaring verse 35, I am the bread of life. And then he follows up with, I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. Everything that the Father gives me will come to me, and anyone who comes to me I will never drive away. And then he follows that up with, this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing at all of what he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. This is indeed the will of my Father, that all who see the Son and believe in him may have eternal life, and I will raise them up on the last day. And I'm pretty sure that a goodly number of his hearers were just lost. Just lost. I mean, I hear, probably you hear, references to Holy Communion and Christ being the second person of the Trinity and the atonement and Jesus' resurrection and one day our promised resurrection. But then we have the advantage of the whole of the New Testament and 2,000 years of processing the death and resurrection of Jesus. But for many that day, they were just left like scratching their heads. And the ones who weren't just bewildered, they were downright angry. Some of the religious authorities began to call out Jesus, demanding an explanation of these wild-sounding things he was saying. But then the explanation that Jesus offers just makes it worse for them. He says, I'm the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever, and the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. Again, we're hearing communion here, but at least some in his audience, what they're hearing is cannibalism, nothing short of cannibalism. It's just too weird, and the religious leaders in the Jewish community even start arguing with each other. And in the 52nd verse of that sixth chapter, they even ask, how can this man serve up his flesh for a meal? Madness! Jesus just doubles down, declaring, only as you eat and drink flesh and blood, the flesh and blood of the Son of Man, do you have life within you. And he just keeps going on in this vein. And to make sure that we capture the audacity of the statements, as we heard in our gospel reading this morning, John, the gospel writer, adds that he said these things while teaching in the synagogue in Capernaum. So he's saying all this smack dab in the middle of the church, amidst this gathering place of the faithful. Oy. In verse 60, we hear how his disciples respond. And remember, these are the people who have been traveling with him. These are the people who know him best, who made a decision to follow. These are disciples. They're not just the crowd. They're not just hangers-on. These disciples, they say, this is really difficult, Jesus. We're not sure if we can swallow this one. And so Jesus comes back and he says, and this offends you? Listen up. I know that some of you here don't believe, but trust me, this is life. Then in verse 66, John notes that because of this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. And no one's calling for him to be king anymore. But do remember that these were the committed who turned back. These aren't the looky-loos who are going out to see whatever tent meeting it was, meeting on the edge of town that night. These aren't those who tune into the latest self-help program late night on TV, just because they're searching for something. No. These were the disciples. The ones who had made the decision to follow Jesus, who'd left people and things behind. These are the ones who've been baptized and taken confirmation classes and, who knows, gave 10 instead of a, or 12 instead of a 10% tithe. You know, like they're really committed. And these are the ones who've transferred their membership. They've signed up for the fall supper. They've attended all the studies. They served in all the church ministries. But they were put off by what Jesus said. They were offended. They were confused. Or they just found Jesus to be too much. So I get why people leave church because of scandal. Because of human failure. Because of the clumsy way we do things on those occasions when we get organized enough to actually do something. We try hard, but we're not always terribly impressive in the church. It's not a big secret to anyone who actually goes to church anywhere. And I suppose I get why people leave the church because of Jesus. I don't know about you. I just find that Jesus is so often like in my face. Yes, he has carried me through some difficult times. When I've been confused, he's come alongside me and helped me get unconfused, or at least functional in my confusion. Sometimes he's actually done that through some of you. At other times he's done it in a more personal way, in a more mysterious way, like he's actually spoken to me. He's helped me get up when I've been down, often through my own idiocy as well as through circumstance. But nonetheless, he's gotten me on my feet again, and he's shouldered my burdens when I've been crushed, and he's softened my heart when it's been hard. I mean, when I sing "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," I actually mean it. I find him endlessly fascinating. I find him attractive and compelling. But he's not easy. I always remember that fabulous episode in C.S. Lewis' marvelous book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I commend it to everyone. It's where the character Susan gets nervous about meeting Aslan the lion for the first time. Now, he's the Jesus figure in the book. And Susan asks, is he quite safe? And she's with two other characters, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And Mrs. Beaver says, if there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. And then Mr. Beaver chimes in. He says, safe? Who has said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. Well, sometimes Jesus' teachings are so alarming that I miss the good. And they get me rather nervous about safety. And I'm not talking about hyperbole, those exaggerations he uses to make a point. You know, like if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. No, I mean the clear stuff. It's the unambiguous stuff, like in Luke 6 when he says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. Love my enemies? And then 16 chapters later, I'm just getting my head around being nonviolent. He says, but now the one who has a purse must take it, and likewise a bag, here it is, and the one who has no sword must sell his cloak and buy one. Come on, Jesus, how do I square that particular circle? Okay, what about this? Whoever divorces and marries another commits adultery. Oh, that's not close to home for us, is it? Or this one. Oh, yeah. Just one more thing, rich guy. Sell what you have and then come and follow me. Those are just a few of the things on my list. I'm confident that you folks could add more to that list. This is the stuff that keeps me awake at night because I get to preach on these things and I honestly wonder, will anyone stay? Perhaps I can find something in there to make it a little less disturbing. You know, maybe I can gently massage Jesus' words into 3 points on how to protect your kids from secularity, or 4 steps to becoming more disciplined in prayer, or 6 ways to have a spiritual conversation with your neighbor. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with those topics, just to the contrary. Those are really worthy things to broach and to preach upon. But what do we do with love God when your daughter has just died? What do we do with love your neighbor when your neighbor is a repulsive, racist jerk? So I think I understand why people leave Jesus. He is not tame. He is not easy. But then again, as Lewis rightly noted, he is good. Got to tell you, for me, the most touching and revealing part of this reading is the conversation at the end when Jesus has been abandoned by so many of his disciples, and he turns to the 12 and he asks, do you want to go too? I'd love to hear his inflection as he said that. It would tell us a lot. Do you want to go too? Do you want to go too? That's a tough question to ask. I mean, Jesus knows how hard this is. He knows. And so he turns to those closest to him, and knowing that they don't even partially understand what he's teaching them, that will come later. I'm sure he knows that. But he asks, do you want to go too? Then again, Simon, he is the stand-in for every one of those who would foolishly say yes to Jesus' invitation to follow. Peter says, to whom can we go? Who else is there? Should we settle for someone easier, someone who gives us a lower bar? Are we to go for some version of Christianity light? Yeah, just believe and say aloud these 4 things, and that's all there is to it. You're in, it's done. Now, Peter says, we have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. there you have it. This is why we stay. Why we stay despite the inarguable fact that the church isn't what it should be, has never been, but strangely enough is referred to as the body of Christ, understood as a spouse loved deeply by Jesus Christ. This is why, even having left, we come back to this most imperfect approximation of what God has called us to be. This is why we follow along, struggling with the challenges of faithfulness, struggling with Jesus' call on us to live in a way that the world just walks away from. My running line, I know for some of you it's gotten a bit tiresome. I'm sorry about that, but it's nonetheless true. My oft-repeated statement is that I've only got one sermon, and it's about Jesus. It's true. It has to be the focus of our conversation here. I would dare say it is meant to be the focus of our conversation in any church in the world. Because when we meet Jesus and when we spend time with him, we do come to believe that he really is the Holy One of God. And after you've discovered that, where else could we go? Amen.